Good morning. It's Wednesday. It's 9 o'clock, and it's time for a conversation on KMUN. We haven't heard the sweet strains of Asturias Leyenda performed by John Williams in a while, and it's great to be on the air with you. Good morning. Welcome to the conversation. My name's Graham Nystrom. Today's a special show. I've got Terry Steenbergen, the executive director of Harbor Northwest, with me, and she has brought along a couple of special guests as well. Terry joins me on the phone. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning, Graham. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you, and I understand that you've talked a couple of other special guests into joining us. Would you like to tell us a little bit about why you're on the radio today and who your guests are?
Sure. So I'm on the radio today because October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. As folks might know, or might not know, Domestic Violence Awareness Month is a time when we remember folks who have been lost to domestic violence, folks who have survived domestic violence and come through, and also the folks who work in the domestic violence universe. And it's also a time where we just bring attention to domestic violence and try and get rid of some of the stigma and shame around talking about it and bring awareness and hopefully work towards ending that cycle of violence. So it's really great to be on the radio with you today to talk more about this.
As a community service organization, we sure appreciate the work that the Harbor does. And you can find the Harbor online at harbornw.org. And they also have a 24-hour crisis line, 503-325-5735. And sorry for interrupting you, but you were going to go on to talk about your guests.
I was, but I will also add that please call us anytime on the crisis line. You can actually also text that line from 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, if you prefer text. Or we also have a chat line that's at harbornw.org/chat. So you can reach us that way as well.
Great.
So my the other guests for today are members of the Domestic Violence Council for Clatsop County, which just came back together this summer. We brought the chair of the Domestic Violence Council, Christopher Hoover, who also works for parole and probation, and the secretary, Amber Bowman. I'll let them tell you a little bit more about themselves if they would like.
Well, it looks like we have Amber ready to go. Good morning, Amber. Thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, Graham. Thank you for having me.
Would you like to tell us a little bit more about who you are and what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. My name's Amber Bowman. I am a youth and family clinician at Clatsop Behavioral Healthcare, and I'm also the secretary of the Domestic Violence Council. I also work with Resilient Clatsop County, which is a trauma-informed network for Clatsop County.
And Chris, I can see you on Zoom, but it looks like you're still muted. Are you with us, Chris?
Yes, I am, Graham.
Great. Thanks for being here. Chris is the parole and probation deputy at Clatsop County Sheriff's Office. And would you like to tell us a little bit about what you do, Chris?
Yeah, it's good to be here, Graham. Thank you. My name is Chris Hoover. I'm a parole and probation deputy with the Clatsop County Sheriff's Office. I do supervise the domestic violence caseload, and I'm the chair of the Domestic Violence Council currently.
Can you tell me a little bit about the Domestic Violence Council and what that group does?
Yeah, so the Domestic Violence Council is a group of professionals across the county from different disciplines, from law enforcement agencies to treatment providers, and we have representatives from other agencies throughout the county, medical professionals, survivors of domestic violence, and we all come together one time every 2 months. We've been meeting monthly to get prepared for Domestic Violence Awareness Month, but our role is really to steer policy and procedure across the county, with how we address domestic violence, use of evidence-based practices for how we address domestic violence in our community, and it's been an honor to lead the charge on that over the last several months.
Well, Amber and Chris, thank you for the work that both of you do, and Terry as well. Terry, can I hand it back to you to continue leading this conversation?
Sure, if you want to. I thought I would actually just talk a little bit about domestic violence itself, just so that you know, folks are clear on what that is. And I guess also I should mention the Harbor, if you don't know, our mission is to provide advocacy, prevention and support to promote self-determination and hope for survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. So we work with survivors all across Clatsop County in any sort of stage that they're in, and our job is to make sure that they receive trauma-informed, confidential services so that they can, you know, find the path or get the support that they need to move forward in whatever way that means. So domestic violence itself, as folks maybe know, is actually, you know, it's a cycle of violence that's perpetrated by one intimate partner onto another. It is, you know, we see domestic violence, and I think most people think of it as being a very physical thing, but it is actually, there's many forms of domestic violence. We see physical violence, sexual violence, emotional, psychological, financial violence. And again, it is a cycle of violence. And so if people have heard of that, there's different stages to the whole process. You know, there's a time of tension, there's a time of eruption where something horrible happens. And then afterwards, there's like this time of reconciliation and calm where the abuser is asking for forgiveness or saying, well, you know, that wouldn't have happened if, or, you know, bring flowers and candy. And I think the thing that it's important to remember about that cycle is that the whole thing can be very abusive, you know, not sort of knowing what's going to happen next. I just wanted to also share that domestic violence is a lot more common, I think, than people think it is. across the United States, 1 in 3 women have experienced some sort of physical violence from an intimate partner, and 1 in 4 men have experienced some sort of physical violence from an intimate partner. And again, that's just physical violence, and so we see these other forms of violence coming out, so it's probably even more prevalent than we might think it is. On a typical day throughout the country, there are more than 20,000 phone calls to domestic violence hotlines around the country every single day, which I think is pretty staggering. And intimate partner violence actually accounts for about 15% of all violent crime. Unfortunately, in Oregon, 37% of women have actually experienced violence, physical violence from an intimate partner. So in Oregon, the stats are a little bit higher than they are in the rest of the country. And then I think the last thing I wanted to share about that is that we also see that in teens, about 1 in 3 teenagers in the United States are a victim of physical, sexual, emotional, or verbal abuse from an intimate partner. So I think that number is pretty staggering, and I think we see a lot of that in the teen population as well.
Well, that definitely gets our conversation off to a start. Terry, I'm noticing that your phone audio sounds a little scratchy. I'm wondering if I can have you hang up and just ring us right back, and I'll pick up right away.
Okay, sure.
So give us a buzz right back. Thanks. While we're waiting for Terry to call back in, one of the things that we were going to tell you about is what's happening this month called the Purple Light Project. And so as soon as Terry's back on the line... Hey, Terry, I was telling folks that we would hear about the Purple Light Project.
Oh, yeah. Great.
Okay. Still a little scratchy, but it was worth a try. Thanks for going through the motions.
Sure. Am I talking about the Purple Light Project, or does somebody else want to?
Chris or Amber, do you have thoughts on that, or would you like Terry to take the lead on that one? Looks like Chris might have something.
Well, I think it's appropriate to have Terry take the lead on that, and then I can talk about how the council has wanted to support and have come alongside the Harbor to support that project.
Great.
Great. Thanks, Chris. So the Purple Light Project, we started actually last year. You know, Domestic Violence Awareness Month is a time where we all try and come together and bring a lot of awareness to domestic violence in various different ways through events and activities and trying really to get out into the community and talk to people more about the issues. of course, last year was a different year for all of us. It was hard to do in-person events and really get out there. And so we started this Purple Light project where we've been selling purple light bulbs mostly to businesses around Clatsop County for them to put in either their shop windows or out front of their store with a little display of posters about Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Just so that we can bring awareness to domestic violence, so as people are sort of safely walking down the street and social distancing, they're able to see those lights and ask questions about why everybody is lit up in purple over the course of the month. And last year, it was very successful. I think we had quite a few businesses were involved last year, and so we decided to do it again this year. And I think we're actually a lot more businesses are getting involved. It's cool to see sort of on the main streets the lights lighting up, and I think some individuals also are putting purple lights up. And I think it also just shows that the community really does support survivors. And, you know, one of the things about domestic violence is that it happens in isolation. Nobody wants to talk about it. And so knowing that the community backs survivors is really helpful for folks who are doing the work and also the survivors themselves.
So if you're listening and you'd like to be a part of the Purple Light Project, then please do contact the Harbor. The Harbor also has an office line that you can call, 503-325-3426. Chris, how about you?
So the Domestic Violence Council, we started meeting again in July, and we realized that with the rates of domestic violence rising around the country, about 8.1%, that we owed it to our community to rally together and get behind some projects for Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And so, of course, that's always tricky in a pandemic, right? Because you want to be out in the community interacting, having those conversations, but then we're, you know, we've got this interesting social situation that we're all dealing with. And so we were very fortunate to be able to support the Harbor and the Purple Light Project. And I spent a Sunday down at the Harbor tent at the Astoria Sunday Market. And what I want to say about that, we were able to have a lot of conversations in the open air about the Purple Light Project, what it represents in our community. But I think more importantly, like, I had so many conversations that day from people that were impacted in the community and the good work that the Harbor does, and the people that actually came up to the tent and told their stories and how they weren't able to navigate those situations. They wouldn't have been able to navigate those situations without the support and the help of the Harbor. And that's just a testament to the good work that they do. And I was, you know, I really saw that as a great experience to be able to, spend a day and to get to hear those stories. And the council has rallied behind the Harbor on this project, and the response from the two Sundays that I'm aware of that we were working at the Sunday market, the response was great from folks in the community. And there were a lot of people that bought light bulbs, and the also law enforcement agencies that got behind the project. So so that was one project that we got that we wanted to support. And there was another project that the group wanted to support, and Amber can talk a little bit more about that if that's appropriate.
Absolutely.
Well, I just want to echo first what Chris said about the great work that the Harbor has done and is doing and continues to do for our community. The stories of hope and resilience that I hear, I'm just grateful that we have them as a resource in our community. And before I talk about the Silent Witness campaign, which is the other domestic violence awareness campaign that the council decided to do, I did want to say that as a survivor myself, one of the things that I love about our county is how we come together and we rally to support one another when there's a tragedy. But at the same time, being in a small rural town, it's difficult to talk openly about some of those difficult things that we face, and from fear of judgment and knowing that it is a small community. So getting normalizing the conversation and reducing the stigma is such a huge, important part of reducing domestic violence and reducing the impact that it has on our community and on our families. So I just really appreciate the opportunity to come on the air and talk about it, because it's just really important that we have these conversations.
So one of the things that stood out to me that you just mentioned was normalizing the conversation. Mm-hmm. Can you expand on that just a little bit more?
Absolutely. So, you know, something that's always interested me is when you look at data for violent deaths, and you look at homicides, the numbers for, you know, just homicides and gun violence and things like that, you know, they're talked about, they're reported about, they're discussed openly. You know, there's campaigns about, you know, stopping the violence. And when it comes to domestic violence and suicide as well, that those are kind of taboo topics. I think anything really dealing with mental health can kind of push people away. And there's just so much stigma around it. And I think that it's important that people realize that those things are, you know, part of the challenges that we face as a community, and that we are all kind of responsible for coming together and dealing with these problems. And, you know, just like I said, it's really interesting to me that certain types of violence is not talked about openly as compared to other types of violence. So, if I may talk about the Silent Witness campaign for a moment.
Please.
So this is one of the ways to normalize the conversation and reduce stigma and raise that awareness and have people, you know, confronted with the statistics and encourage conversations. So the Silent Witness Project began in 1990 in Minnesota, and it was a group of women that had decided to put together a campaign to raise awareness. I think there was about 26 deaths attributed to domestic violence that year in 1990. And so what this group of women did was create these cardboard cutouts that of women and children that had narratives written on the chest. It's just these silhouettes, and the narratives are the stories of those 26 women. And so there were 26 silhouettes, and that initiative has just grown throughout the country. It's in all 50 states. There's campaigns in all 50 states now. And that's something that Clatsop County, that we wanted to do, is start our own Silent Witness campaign. And we're grateful for Choices Counseling. They made a large donation that helped us actually purchase a few cutouts to get that effort started. And we have a great campaign this year, but we plan on making it even bigger and greater next year.
That sounds great. Is this something that folks can help with in any way that are listening? How would someone participate in this?
Well, I appreciate you asking that. So we have, at this point, we do have businesses that are planning on displaying the cutouts in our community. As far as fundraising and purchasing more cutouts for the future, those are tasks that we haven't really dealt with as a council, but we will plan on meeting and talk about the future and ways that people can get more involved for the future of the campaign.
And to piggyback on that involvement question, I would throw that to you as well. Chris, are there, you know, I think that the folks that listen to KMUN are active participants in the community. And so is there any sort of a call to action for volunteers, or is this more of a group of professionals that you guys are working with on the different councils?
That's a good question. We've had a solid community response. We have two individuals on the council that are working specifically with community members. They've done community outreach, gone to local businesses, and we have a list of businesses that would like to sponsor the standees for a week at a time. If you would like to sponsor a standee, you can contact me and I will make sure that we get a standee at your location for a week. And I will work with the two domestic violence council members that are going to be distributing the standees throughout the rest of this year. We figure with the domestic violence tends to escalate through the holidays. And so this is going to be a campaign that's not just for the month of October, but we're going to run through the rest of this year through the holidays. I can be reached. Do you want me to give you my contact information?
Yes, please do.
So you can reach me at 503-338-3782. That rings right to my desk. And if you would like a standee at your business, I will connect you with a DV council member and we'll make that happen.
Excellent. Terry, we haven't heard from you in a little while. Would you like to chime in with anything?
I think Chris and Amber covered all this really well, and I just want to say thanks so much to both of them for all the hard work they've been putting in as well to this campaign. And it's been just, I think having the Domestic Violence Council back together again and receiving the support from the community has meant a lot to us. And it's just, I think it's just such a great way to support survivors in the county. So I just want to say thank you for that. And I'm excited about the Silent Witness campaign. I think it makes sense for us to have the campaign going throughout the year. I mean, Domestic Violence, Awareness Month is in October, but of course it is always a problem. And so bringing awareness to it is, really what we need to be doing.
Yeah, and if you're just joining us, you're listening to The Conversation on KMUN. I'm Graham Nystrom, and we have Terry Steenbergen, the Executive Director of The Harbor. We have Amber Bowman, Secretary of the Domestic Violence Council, Youth and Family Clinician at Clatsop Behavioral Healthcare, and a survivor. And we have Chris Hoover, Parole and Probation Deputy at the Clatsop County Sheriff's Office, who supervises the domestic violence caseload and also chairs the Clatsop County Domestic Violence Council. We've heard about October being Domestic Violence Awareness Month, why we do it. We heard some statistics, and we heard about the Purple Light Project. It sounds like, Terry, you wanted to bring some special awareness to sexual assault services as part of domestic violence.
Yes, I do. I think that one of the things about the Harbor, we've been around for 45 years this year, actually. We've had a lot of different iterations. We started as a crisis line, we've had shelters, we've had transitional housing, we've done sort of a lot of different things. And a couple of years ago when we were doing some assessments and outreach, discovered that a lot of people really recognize the Harbor as an organization that works with women who are domestic violence survivors in a shelter. And yes, we do those things, but we are so much more than that. As I said before, domestic violence does touch everybody, women and men, people of all genders. We find that domestic violence, occurs in the non-binary community as well. Every race, every religion, everybody is affected by domestic violence. So to start that off, we do provide services for everybody who needs them. And then unfortunately, one of the parts of domestic violence is sexual assault. So we do provide separate sexual assault services to survivors of sexual assault. But one thing to know is that about 40 to 45% of people who are in abusive relationships are actually sexually assaulted. And about 50% of those people, sexual assaults happen on more than one occasion in the relationship. And so the two things, people always think of them as being very separate, are actually really tied together. And so I just wanted to bring awareness to that and let everybody know that, whether you know, you're a domestic violence survivor or you're a sexual assault survivor or you're experiencing sexual assault in your relationship, that we are available to provide services to folks, that we can accompany people to medical exams at the hospital if that's what they want to do. We can help people navigate reporting an incident if that's what they want to do. We will work with people even if they decide not to report, which, you know, sometimes, you know, people aren't ready to report what's happened to them but do want to talk to somebody. And so we're available for that too. We know that if somebody reaches out to us for support and actually has support from an advocate while they're going through the process of a sexual assault exam at the hospital and talks about options about reporting, that they actually are more likely to reach out and report than if they don't seek services from us. So we are available to sexual assault survivors for any of that process, or even if they don't want to do any of the things I just talked about, we're also available to just talk about what happened or just listen, because that's one of the things that our advocates of course, are really good at, is just listening and being there, because we will never encourage somebody to do something they don't necessarily want to do. We'll just let them know sort of what they can do and help them get to the point that they want to be at and help them with that part of the process.
I'd like to ask a question, and I would welcome an answer from any one of the three of you who would like to answer, and that is, if someone is experiencing domestic violence or sexual assault, I wonder if it's common that the self-talk that person would have is that this isn't a big enough deal, this isn't a bad enough problem, that I don't deserve to report it or to get help. Is that something that you encounter, that there's this like threshold of severity that people think they need to cross before they can call and get help? You know, because I would say from my perspective, you know, no question is too small, no example is not important enough to receive treatment or to receive help on. Is that something you've experienced, Terry or Chris or Amber?
Unless Chris or Amber wants to jump in, I can start off. I'd say that, I mean, yes, a little bit. I you know, with domestic violence, we see that it doesn't start off as, you know, extreme physical violence necessarily, right? It starts off with maybe emotional and psychological abuse, like, you know, being belittled or isolated, but not being physically abused. And so a lot of times, like, it's not really clear necessarily. People are like, this doesn't feel right, but it's not, you know, he's not hitting me. And I apologize for saying he, but we do know that primarily women are affected by domestic violence. But, it starts off differently. So I think there is a tendency to say, well, you know, I'm not going to call somebody because I don't know necessarily if it's a problem. And we are there even if people don't know, right? We also like to talk about healthy relationships. We're there to help people sort of like figure out like where they're at in their relationship and if they feel like things might escalate at some point, or to just talk about what the options are if things do escalate, or, you know, whatever point somebody is at in that process. I think the other thing that keeps people from reporting, besides the stigma just around talking about domestic violence, you know, it used to be something that it was like, it's between, you know, partners, it's between the husband and wife, it's not the business of anybody else. So that used to be a thing. So there's that stigma. And then there's also the part, especially, you know, with both domestic violence and sexual assault, where people feel like it's their fault, right? Around that whole conversation, there's already, you know, there's been, especially with sexual assault survivors, you know, it's like, what was she wearing, or was she drinking, or, you know, what was the thing that was happening beforehand? Or, you know, if you're living in an abusive relationship with a lot of emotional and psychological abuse, you're hearing that you did something wrong, and that's why you deserve for this to happen. So there, I think there's a lot of that, too, of just, like, people feeling like they don't deserve help because they did something to make this happen to them. And what everybody needs to know is that it is not their fault. It is never your fault. And that everybody deserves to live a life free of violence. And nobody deserves to be abused.
Absolutely. So the takeaway for me would be that if you're even asking yourself the question, should I call, then the answer is yes, right?
Yes.
Looks like maybe Amber has something to add.
Yeah, I just want to say that I appreciate that you asked that question. And I think you, Terry, you did bring up about bystanders and how important it is that they make a phone call, but there is dealing with that, you know, oh, that's not my business. Oh, if they find out that I called, are they going to be mad at me? You know, a friend or a neighbor, whoever it is. There's that fear, especially living in a small community. You know, am I bothering law enforcement? Is this, you know, are they going to be like, why did you call? This isn't important. These, you know, those things, the doubt that comes into your mind and you hit the nail on the head too, Terry, pardon my use of phrase, but the self blame and that doubt and shame that a survivor feels is something that stops you from making that call, because you are thinking, you know, I deserve this. This isn't, you know, they're not in the wrong. I asked for this somehow, you know, and that's why it's just so important to have these conversations and to normalize asking for help and to normalize calling. If you see something, you know, say something.
Chris?
So working with perpetrators of violence, you know, the tactics that perpetrators of violence will use will obviously be to silence the survivor in some way, or use tactics to blame or even minimize. And so when somebody is caught up in that, caught up in the violence and in a relationship with an individual that likely has narcissistic traits, and the complexity of that relationship, I think that it adds a challenge to the survivor feeling empowered to speak up. And so, and I think too, with the societal perspective of or the narrative that the survivor did something wrong, and not putting the accountability and blame on the perpetrator of violence, I think is something that we want to change within our community. And that's through the Domestic Violence Awareness Month. We want to normalize those conversations and encourage people to speak up.
Yeah, and really pay attention to how things are framed. I want to say that Instagram is actually a really good source for seeing how language can change and improve, whether it's about domestic violence or about Indigenous issues. But one of the things that I've been seeing lately is getting away from the statistic of how many women are raped to how many men rape. And so putting that lens of fault or even just the act itself on the perpetrator, like you're saying.
Exactly. Putting the accountability where it needs to be on the perpetrator of violence, and encouraging survivors to speak up and to call the police and to reach out to the harbor if there's any doubt that there's violence going on in the home, and to reach out, that there is support, that people will listen.
Chris, I have a question for you. I'm curious about the role that the sheriff's department plays versus the role that police departments play, and how you divide these caseloads. Who handles what? Who's the better organization to call if you need help? Or does that have more to do with where you are, where you live?
It does have a lot to do with where you live. So if you live in Warrenton, then you'll want to call Warrenton Police. If you live in Seaside, you'll call Seaside Police. Cannon Beach Police. If you're living in outlier communities, then you'll call the Clatsop County Sheriff's Office. Dispatch, if you call the dispatch number, they will get you to the correct agency. And so that's really who would respond to a domestic violence event. And then from there, the investigation would go to the DA's office. And what we're working to do with the DV Council is how do we make ourselves more effective when we respond to those events? Because usually there's a window of time where the survivor has this opportunity to tell their story to law enforcement. Maybe the something has happened in the home where things have escalated out of control and they had to make that call. There's that window of opportunity for them to share what's going on. And oftentimes that window is short because of the tactics of perpetrators of violence, because of the tactics of narcissistic or antisocial individuals that engage in those violent behaviors. So we are working to make sure that those agencies are utilizing the ODERA, it's a risk assessment tool, when they go out to a call. And then if they can ask the questions that are outlined in this evidence-based tool, then we can really assess how serious the situation is. So what, you know, sort of what we're wanting to do with the, when you have an officer go out to respond to a call, that we're utilizing those evidence-based practices and asking those risk assessment questions so that we can accurately assess the risk to the victim and to the children and then respond accordingly.
I'm curious if each of these departments has people who are more trained specifically to handle these calls, or do they just kind of whoever's in the neighborhood takes the call? You know, does everybody get the same amount of training?
So obviously when you have a new officer, they go through the academy and they are maybe not going to have that domestic violence specific training. That's something that comes with time. When we started the council back up in July, I sent out a survey to the different individuals and agencies that were going to be involved in the council so that we could kind of pin down what is it that we need to target as a group? What do we need to focus on? And the two areas within that survey that sort of rose to the top was we need to make sure that our officers are trained adequately. We need to make sure that law enforcement agencies are responding to these calls in a way that we are providing the survivors with the resources that they need to connect with support or maybe get out of that situation. So the other issue was working collaboratively. So that looks, in order for us to address those issues, the council is going to need to focus on making sure that the training is going out to all the different agencies, which is going to be one of our primary focuses in 2022, but also to make sure that we are working effectively and that we are having those conversations, those interagency conversations, and working collaboratively in that way.
And then my final question is, and maybe this is just completely dependent on the situation, but would you recommend a first call to dispatch or a first call to the harbor? Maybe that depends.
I guess it depends on if you have a scenario where it's escalating out of control quickly. Obviously, the call should be to 911 and then a call to the harbor. Mm-hmm. I would also recommend that a call to the harbor immediately. So it kind of needs to be to both, mm-hmm. so that we can get the resources dispatched to that survivor and to the children in that home in the most effective way that we can. And so it probably should happen concurrently.
So segueing out of this into domestic violence and housing, Terry, to what extent, well, do you want to kind of give an overview first of what the housing services are through the harbor?
Sure. So we don't really have a lot, ton of housing services, but so we do have an emergency shelter option. So folks who are, I just wanted to say that to sort of tag onto what Chris was just saying is that if somebody is in an unsafe situation, we're not equipped to, you know, help them in that moment.
Right.
So just to sort of say that you know we can't, you know, we can help after they are stable, and so if somebody is definitely unsafe, then there's not much we can do for them in that moment. That being said, so we do provide emergency shelter. So if somebody is in a very unsafe situation and needs to leave immediately, we do have an emergency shelter. That resource has been pretty stretched, especially since the pandemic, with sort of making it a little bit more of a limited option. And so we do use other things around the county, like hotels or other kinds of places. But, you know, one of the things that folks will need to do is you know, get out of the situation that they're in. Sometimes that means people are thinking about it ahead of time, so that the next time that they can leave, they are able to leave, or just in that moment of violence when they need to get themselves and their children away, we can provide emergency shelter. We do also have the ability sometimes to help people find housing. Last year with the pandemic, there was an increase in funding to actually help people pay for housing. And so we were able to do that. But we generally work, we work very closely with CCA, Classic Community Action, to help folks get into their programs and actually get support around housing and utilities. So that's sort of the way that we're able to help people with the housing thing. All that being the case, though, even though there has been more funding, and one of the problems, as I think everybody knows, in Clatsop County is that there is a housing crisis, and, you know, it's hard to find a place to live. So even if you have, even if you're not a survivor and you have an income and are able to either buy your own home or rent basically anywhere, it is very difficult to find a place to live in Clatsop County. And so the impact that has had on survivors is enormous. You know, people can wait months before they find a place to go. And I think this is true of a lot of resources. I mean, the housing resources, childcare. We also have a lack of childcare. So, you know, if you're in a domestic violence situation, you have a roof over your head, your children have a roof over their heads, and they're being fed. A lot of folks who are in particularly isolating situations don't have jobs because their whole lives are being controlled. And so, when you leave that situation, you need to find all of the things. You need housing, you need childcare, you need a job. And given that there is a lack of housing and a lack of childcare, people are being forced to stay with their abusers sometimes because there's no other option. The other option is to live on the streets. Or they can find housing, but they can't find a job because they have nowhere to take their children. And so we're just seeing that it's you know, everything's compounded by that. We know that, you know, it can take survivors on average about 7 times to leave before they actually leave for good. In rural areas, that number gets up to about 14 or 15 times just because of the resource issue. And like one of those big issues is this, you know, is the housing and the childcare thing that I'm talking about, where, you know, given 2 options, one is to be abused but have all of your basic needs met, other basic needs met, I guess, versus living on the street where it's also dangerous and the likelihood of abuse on the street is actually also very high. Well, you know, you're sort of forced to choose the lesser of the two evils, which in this case is staying home with your dealer.
Right. If you're just tuning in, this is The Conversation on KMUN. I'm Graham Nystrom, your host, and we're speaking today with Terry Steenbergen, the executive director of The Harbor, Amber Bowman, secretary of Domestic Violence Council, youth and family clinician at Clatsop Behavioral Health Care, and Chris Hoover, parole and probation deputy at the Clatsop County Sheriff's Office, who also supervises the domestic violence caseload and chairs the Clatsop County Domestic Violence Council. Amber, your work at Clatsop Behavioral Healthcare, does that intersect with what we're talking about today, or is it more your work as the secretary on the Domestic Violence Council?
It absolutely intersects. I think that, you know, and it also intersects with my work with the Resilient Clatsop County, which, you know, I'm hearing lots of conversations about resources and things like that. And it just makes me think of how important it is that there is, you know, conversations across organizations, and that there's open communication across sectors and everybody coming together to support one another. The work that I'm doing is, you know, really focused on trauma-informed care and identifying ways to build resilience. I don't know if you're familiar with the ACEs study, Adverse Childhood Experiences. And there's just brief synopsis. There was a study that showed that the more traumatic, adverse childhood experiences an individual has, it's directly related to increase, health problems in the future and other issues. And so it's about reducing the trauma impact and building resilience for the children. And domestic violence is trauma. That is a traumatic event. Witnessing interpersonal violence, that is a traumatic event. And that has a huge impact on the children. And if they aren't given the tools to be resilient and given the support to be resilient, then that is going to lead to, you know, lifelong issues that have an impact on them and our community. And so really addressing the trauma, building resilience is a huge part of my work.
It seems like, mentioning how important taking care of the young ones who either are victims or witnesses to domestic violence. Can any of you speak to programs that are being offered in schools? Like Terry, does the Harbor visit the local high schools every year? Or, you know, to what extent do we have curriculum in place to help young folks?
We do, yes. So the answer to your question is yes, kind of. So last year we started a comprehensive prevention program, which is focused in high schools at the moment. And that is, we have it's a 10 to 12 week curriculum where we actually, you know, teach high school students about healthy relationships and prevention, and also, you know, the signs of abuse and what abuse actually is. I think we found, you know, I think we see, and Amber can probably speak to this also, that there is quite a bit of, as I mentioned earlier, you know, there's a lot of abuse happening in the teenage population. You know, very few of us learned at a young age what healthy relationships look like. And as people grow up, they, you know, their idea of what a relationship is what they're seeing, right? So if they're growing up in a home with their parents or, you know, whoever that they're growing up with is living in an unhealthy relationship, that's the relationship that they're seeing. And so the curriculum that we teach is really revolves around what are healthy relationships and what they look like. We also talk a lot about what sexual violence is and what that looks like. So it can be, you know, obviously rape is sexual violence, but also, you know, people sending you, you know, nudie pictures on your phone or harassing, you know, sexual harassment, that can also, you know, really hurt somebody. So just having conversations about that. And then I think the other piece to the violence piece is that there's a lot of technological violence happening in the teenage community. So with social media and texting and people being on their phones more, a lot of that violence is happening in those online social areas. But it's, you know, invisible to the rest of the world, so it's harder for everybody else to see. So we also really try and help students understand that piece as well. So we have been working, we're actually at Warrenton High School at the moment. We've worked with Astoria High School, and we've been out in Napa. We're also working with the kids at Tongue Point at the moment, now that they're back. Actually, our hope is that we can get in there a little bit more. And then we also spend quite a bit of time working with the Lower Columbia Q Center, and working with the kids in the youth group over there.
That's great.
But we'd love to reach out to all of the schools, basically, in the county. Yeah.
Well, if you're affiliated with a school and you're listening, please don't hesitate to contact Terry at the Harbor. Let's see. We've got about 10 minutes left in the hour, and I wanted to make sure that we had a chance to talk about what the impacts of the pandemic have been on your work. And Terry, you mentioned that housing is stretched very thin as a direct result of increased domestic violence during the pandemic. And then at the end of the show, we're going to close with Amber telling one of the stories from one of the standees. So stay tuned for that. Amber, do you have any input on how the pandemic has affected your work in this last year and a half plus?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the pandemic has affected my work at this in similar way as, you know, anyone else who's employed outside of their home, right? Is that the job completely changed as far as ability to, you know, to provide resources and provide care, but also it looks different now as far as, you know, some people, you know, are not comfortable coming in person. And so there's, you know, virtual counseling, and it's different. It can be, you know, just as good, but, you know, just the actual physical changes of the space and things like that. But I think what's also just incredibly important to keep in mind is that the pandemic itself is a trauma that we are all experiencing, and it's affecting us all in different ways and to different lengths, but we are all experiencing a shared trauma. And it's, you know, I think adding on top of everything that other people or that people are already dealing with, a pandemic, which complicates getting resources and things like that. It just, it's created a more difficult situation. And, you know, in some situations, a more desperate situation. So I'm glad to find unique ways and be innovative and, you know, meet the needs of the community during this unique time. But I think that it's really important to remember that we're all still very much experiencing this shared trauma.
Absolutely. Agreed. Well, thank you for working so hard to pivot and to respond and work in new ways during this difficult time. Chris, do you have any insights on how the pandemic has affected your work?
Yes, it's certainly, there's been an uptick in domestic violence. Seems like more intakes over the last 2 years from adjudicated domestic violence crimes. You know, people are at home more. They're stuck at home with their, you know, their family members, and the perpetrators of violence are at home more. And so there's more opportunities for that interpersonal conflict and escalation. So it's been a challenge. And then jails and prisons, not that that's always a great answer, but sometimes it is the answer to providing a survivor with the space to get a restraining order or a stalking order. And with the pandemic, sometimes those individuals don't get held. I have to say that the lieutenant at the jail has been really open to when there have been situations where I've had to intervene because there was physical violence going on in the home, and for the safety of the victim, they were able to hold those individuals to provide some space for survivors. So that adds another layer of challenge when you can't provide that time out when it is absolutely necessary for the safety of the survivor and the children in the home. But I have to, you know, compliment the, you know, the lieutenant at the jail being willing to be open-minded enough to hear that, okay, we've got to make an exception in this situation just for survivor safety. And so that's been really helpful despite the challenges.
Yeah, agility is such a hard skill right now, as is pushing through the collective trauma and continuing to treat each other with kindness and compassion. I think that as a radio person, I know the power of a story, and so to kind of wrap things up, I'd like to invite Amber to share one of the stories from one of these standees that you can support at your business. And if you're interested, we'll give that contact information out one more time at the end of the show. So Amber, would you like to share that story with us?
Absolutely. So the stories that I have are actually from the original 27 silent witnesses. And at this point, we don't have the narratives printed out for the local standees. But I think that, you know, that you'll find some similarities in what's going to be printed on these standees.
Okay.
So, okay. Beverly Miller, 16 years old, June 10th, 1990. She was a teenager living in Roseville, Minnesota. She was stabbed 22 times in a triple stabbing that left her sister and a friend injured. She died wrapped in a blanket on the sofa. Her sister's former boyfriend, previously charged with domestic violence, was charged with first-degree murder in her death. Would you like me to read another one?
Yeah, we definitely have time for one more.
Okay. Beverly Lone Eagle, 31 years old, July 27th, 1990. She had previously sought shelter as a battered woman. She was pushed from a car, then struck and killed while walking along the old Bemidji Highway. Her husband was charged with second-degree manslaughter in her death. He had previously served a reduced sentence for the axe murder of his first wife.
My goodness, I told you stories were powerful.
And I think it might be a good time, too, to remind everyone of those phone numbers that they can call.
Absolutely. We'll start with the Harbors Crisis Line. This is a 24-hour line, and you can also text this number, and that's 503-325-5735. And also the Clatsop County Crisis Line is another 24/7 number, and that's 503-325-5724. And there's also a national domestic violence hotline available 24/7 at 1-800-799-7233. If your business is interested in supporting a standee, you can contact Chris at 503-338-3782. That rings right to his desk, and he'd be happy to help you out with that. And is there anything that I've forgotten from any of you?
Can I just say one more thing, Karen?
Please do, Terry.
I just wanted to remind folks that, again, at any point that people are in a relationship, whether they're still wondering if it's an unhealthy relationship or if abuse might be actually present, they should feel free to call us. We are there to help. And all of our services are completely confidential. So anything that anybody tells us about anything that has happened is going to stay with the advocate that they shared that information with, unless the survivor puts down in writing that they want it to be shared and specifically with who. So, you know, if people are able to tell their story confidentially, we can really work with them to figure out what they want to do next. So we're definitely a good resource for people who just don't know where to go and what's happening. And again, you know, feel free to call us whether you're just trying to figure out what's next, or if you are trying to leave a violent situation. We're definitely there to support folks, and our advocates are there to listen.
Well, Terry, thank you so much for joining us today. And also my thanks to Chris Hoover and, Amber Bowman. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. You've been listening to The Conversation, and Terry, Amber, and Chris, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Graham.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Take care, y'all.